Flora tried to gauge the Fitrastan general, but found herself lacking. Holm didn't seem like the hard-bitten type forged on the frontier, nor the soldier of fortune Olam described. To be honest, I thought we should meet as soon as possible, and this is the first time I've been able to pull myself away from my duties.
I see.
Holm clicked her tongue as if mildly annoyed.
Well, we're here now. I'd like to congratulate you on your victory the other day. My scouts arrived just at the tail end, but I'm told it was rather something. Holding the line against a superior force until your cavalry could hit them from behind. Exactly what I'd expect from Lady Flint.
I'm flattered, General, but I either win or die. I prefer to do the former. Holm chuckled.
And that's exactly what I expect an Adran General to say. Eminently practical.
She clapped her hands together. Excuse my delight, Lady Flint, but this is just too much. I've always wanted to meet you. I wish I could show you the hospitality of my camp.
You'll forgive my refusal, considering the arrest warrant I was served by your colonel the other day. A Fitrastan army camp seems less than welcoming right now.
Holm's eyes tightened.
Oh, yes, that. I'm unaware of the circumstances of the warrant and will freely say I disagree with arresting a foreign war hero who's fighting for Fitrastan battles on our behalf.
Does this mean you're going to ignore it? Flora asked hopefully. You outnumber the Dianais, but I understand your army was hastily assembled, and I think you could use our experience when you go to retake Lanfor.
You are going to retake Lanfor, aren't you?
That is my ultimate mission, Holm said. Unfortunately, I have every intention of arresting you. I'm a great admirer, but Lady Chancellor Lindet has won my loyalty too many times for me to disobey direct order.
Flora wondered if Holm knew about Lindet's abandonment of Lanfor, but bit her tongue. Throwing mud over Lindet's name was not going to win Holm's friendship.
You're aware that my men have no intention of allowing me to be arrested?
I'd hoped that you'd come along quietly.
Holm paused thoughtfully, then continued.
I'm convinced this is a misunderstanding. If you are willing to accept my hospitality, you will be treated as a guest in my camp until we are able to meet with Lindet in person. Your wounded will be cared for, your men given safe passage back to Adro, or allowed to fight with the Fitrastan Foreign Legion if they'd like. You'd have my word that no harm would come to you under my care. And I would be an advocate in whatever dispute you have with the Lady Chancellor.
Olam leaned forward, whispering, That's a better offer than the Dianais gave you.
Much, Flora murmured. She considered her run-in with Lindet back in Lanfor.
Unfortunately, I don't think you can promise my safety, General Holm.
Holm's eyebrows rose.
Who was that?
I tried to arrest Lindet for crimes against her own country right before the Dianais arrived. We put our differences aside just long enough to defend Lanfor.
And then, Flora added silently, that bitch fled without lifting a finger to help hold a city.
Well, Holm scoffed, you certainly have a pair of balls worthy of your reputation.
She held up a hand as if she needed a moment to digest this new information.
I'm aware that Lindet is far from perfect, but crimes against her own country?
Flora considered telling her about the Godstones and Lindet's ambitions, but decided against it. The story was too far-fetched, and even if Holm believed it, she might very well think Lindet deserved to get her hands on them. Instead, Flora offered a small shrug.
I believe that Lindet will have me executed the moment she gets a chance, and so I must refuse your offer.
Holmes' brow furrowed, and Flora was surprised to hear a note of genuine sadness in her voice.
I'm sorry to hear that, Lady Flint. Am I to understand that I should consider your army that of an enemy?
The implications of that were immediately clear. Flora's men would be shot on sight, and Holmes would probably begin the morning by crossing the river in a flanking action to encircle Flora's army. At which point, she could either force a fight, or simply wait for Flora's men to run out of rations and surrender. The question of the Dionysian army made the entire situation much murkier.
"Tell me," Flora said, "did you bring Privileged?"
Holmes' reply was frosty.
"That is not information I will tell you if we are enemies."
"Our scouts say they have 3 Privileged,"
Olam cut in. Holmes opened her mouth, a scowl on her face, but Flora simply held up her hand.
"I'm not threatening you, and I have no intention of murdering your Privileged, unless we engage in combat. I just wanted to warn you that the Dianes do not have either Bone Eyes or Privileged with them. But they are bloody disciplined, and breaking them will take more than overwhelming force."
"Why are you telling me this?"
"Because whatever happens to me, you're going to fight those Dionys sometime in the next few days, and I'd rather you win than them. Frankly, I think the battle will be more in their favour than you expect."
Holmes chewed on this information, a worried frown on her face, eyeing Flora.
"I'll take this information under advisement."
Flora was cut off by the sound of hooves galloping toward them from the direction of her camp.
"Excuse me," she told Holmes, striding back toward her bodyguard.
She found one of her messengers waiting with them, his chest heaving from a hard ride.
"Is it the Dionys?"
Flora demanded.
"A night attack?"
"No, Mum,"
the messenger said in a hushed tone. "You told me to let you know the moment Taniel and Carpole arrived."
He gestured into the darkness behind him, and Flora was able to make out 2 figures on horseback hanging back in the darkness. She could suddenly sense Taniel's powder magic, as if it had appeared from nothing, as if he were letting her know about his presence. Flora looked at Olam.
"They're here."
"Should we return to camp?"
Olam asked.
"No,"
she said, jerking her head toward the road.
"They're here."
"Oh."
Flora returned to Holmes.
"General, I'm afraid I have to cut this meeting short. Will you allow me to reconsider your offer?"
"Has something changed?"
Holmes asked, peering over Flora's shoulder toward the messenger.
"Maybe."
"I can give you till tomorrow afternoon. Then I will consider the Riflejacks an enemy army."
"Thank you."
Flora turned to leave, then paused.
"Am I to be assured the landfall refugees have your protection?"
"We've already begun to pass out what supplies we can spare. I will take care of them the best I can, and I will not let the Dionys have them."
"Again, thank you," Flora said. "I will answer you tomorrow."
She left the general at the keelboat landing and headed back to her bodyguard to fetch her horse. She and Olam rode ahead toward the 2 figures waiting in the darkness. She could see that both Taniel and Carpole were tired. Their horses were haggard, their clothes covered with the dust of the road. They both wore greatcoats over frontier buckskins, with rifles, swords, and pistols strapped to their saddles. They looked like a pair of bounty hunters chasing an outlaw.
"Good evening," Olam said, tipping his hat.
"Morning, more like it," Taniel responded. "Good to see you again, Olam. Glad you've healed up since landfall."
Carpole waved, "'We would have been here yesterday,' Taniel explained, "'but the Dianais have the roads south of their army buttoned up pretty tight.'
"'What news?' Vlora asked. Taniel shared a look with Karpol, then gave Vlora a tight, tired smile.
"'We found them. We know where the other two godstones are.'
Chapter 8
"'Ben! Wake up!'
Stike stared at the stars, his saddle beneath his head as a pillow, while he stretched out on a bedroll tossed sloppily on the damp grass to keep him dry. He waited to answer until a boot nudged his ribs.
"'I'm awake.'
Ivana leaned over him, peering into his eyes, and gave him a gentle slap on one cheek. "'Then answer when I call.'
"'It's the middle of the night,' Stike replied.
He'd never had a problem sleeping until the labour camps. The pain of his old wounds, the uncertainty he felt toward the guards and the other inmates. He gained the ability to take cat naps, but still had difficulty with real, deep sleep. Since he got out, his rest had been inconsistent, some nights as easy as lying down, while other nights sleep was elusive until late in the morning. This night was one of the latter.
"'I damn well know it's the middle of the night, but there's something you should see.' "'Is it important?'
"'It is for you.' Reluctantly, Stike found his boots and climbed to his feet, glaring at Ivana through the darkness.
"'I was enjoying the quiet.
"'It's not going to be quiet much longer. "'Rumour has it, Flint has a plan up her sleeve, "'and it includes us making a move before sunup.'
"'Is that why you woke me up?'
"'Stike made a fist, then stretched out his fingers, "'repeating the motion to loosen the muscles. "'No, something else.'
Pit.
He thought about ignoring her and throwing himself back to the ground in a futile effort to get a few more hours of sleep. If this was really important, Ivana would have woken up everyone.
Okay, fine. What do you want to show me?
Ivana led him through the Lancer camp and out through their eastern pickets. They didn't exchange another word until they were well beyond earshot of the guards. Then she said, "'How is your hand?'
"'Fine.'
Stike, mid-stretch, buried his left hand in his pocket.
"'Why? Celine telling you stories?'
"'She's worried about you.'
"'Yeah? Well, I'm more worried about you telling a little girl that I need to stop feeling sorry for myself.'
Ivana paused briefly before continuing their walk.
"'And I need to teach her how to keep secrets. Not from me, you don't.
"'Every girl keeps secrets from her dad,' Ivana said with a note of bemusement, "'just like every boy keeps them from his mum.'
"'Dad? What an odd notion.'
Stike had no way of knowing if he had a few bastards scattered around for Traster, but he'd certainly never thought of himself as a father. But with Celine, it felt right.
I wouldn't know.
Another pause.
Sorry.
Stike rolled his eyes. 30 years or more since his father murdered his mother. It was underhanded to play that card, but he was tired and irritable, and Ivana hadn't yet told him why she was dragging him all the way out here.
"'It's fine. What's going on here, anyway? You didn't wake me up to ask after my health.'
"'No,' Ivana said. "'I didn't.' She gestured ahead of them, and Stike looked up to see the distant outline of a small farmhouse with a light flickering in the single window. He scowled, curious, but allowed Ivana to lead him onward until they were almost to the house. It was an old farmsteader's plot, a one-room home with rotting timber walls and a low sod roof.
"'Who lives here?'
Stike asked.
"'No idea. We found it empty, but it seemed apt for our needs.' "'But what needs were—'
Stike trailed off as Ivana opened the door, and they both stepped inside.
Everything of value had been cleared out of the house, leaving bare walls and a dirt floor. A single lantern hung from the rafters and illuminated three men. Stike recognized two of them. Marcus and Zack were a pair of Brudanian brothers in their mid-thirties, ugly as sin and dressed in rags that helped them blend in when they were out scouting. The brothers were old Mad Lancers, two of the original group that had helped Stike terrorize the Kez army all those years ago. The third figure was a bigger man, kneeling between the brothers with a burlap sack over his head and hands bound behind his back.
"Arternoon, Colonel," Marcus said cheerily, snapping a salute. "That's the middle of the night, you twit," Zack told him. "Don't make no difference. Night, afternoon, all just a construct of the modern man." "Oh, don't start this shit again." "It's true. If it weren't for man, the sun in the sky wouldn't care what we call each particular time of day." "Why, I bet."
Stike cleared his throat and Marcus's mouth shut. Stike glanced at Ibana, who'd taken up a spot by the window and now stood watching the small group impassively.
"Who's all this?" Stike asked.
Ibana nodded at the two brothers. They exchanged a glance and Zack spoke up.
"It's a little bit of a story, Colonel, sir, if you don't mind me telling it."
"Make it short," Stike said,
though his curiosity was piqued. He squinted at the kneeling man, wondering who was hidden beneath that burlap. He had the distinct impression he knew the prisoner.
"You remember the day they took you to the firing squad?"
Marcus punched his brother in the shoulder. He hissed,
"Of course he remembers, fool. Don't be insensitive." "Right, well," Zack cleared his throat, "Marky and I, we spent a lot of time thinking about that day."
"Me too," Stike said slowly.
"On that day, the Black Hats came and took our weapons, then carried you away. They put you to the firing squad before we could organize ourselves, and afterward they didn't even leave us a body. We had a funeral for you the next day."
"That's touching," Stike interrupted, "but I don't know what you're getting at."
"He said short, you prick," Marcus whispered.
He cleared his throat and took off where his brother left off.
"What he's getting at is this, sir. There were four of us missing from the funeral."
Stike felt his eyes narrow, and now he couldn't take his gaze from the kneeling form. He was beginning to have his suspicions about who was under that burlap bag and about where this story was going. It was not a direction he wanted to follow.
"Thing is, sir, we gave up our weapons because four of us convinced the rest that the Black Hats were going to give 'em right back. And those four that made that argument, well, they weren't at your funeral. So, a couple of years ago, me and Zack decided to track 'em down. Did some asking, dug around a little bit in back channels. All four of 'em wound up with a windfall from Lindt's regime right after the war. They got paid off for something, sir."
"You're saying they betrayed me?" Stike asked bluntly.
He resisted the idea. He didn't want to consider that any of his lancers would turn on him. But slowly, it began to make sense. His memories of the day were fuzzy at best, but he remembered an argument among the lancers before they were disarmed. There was no way Fidelis Jess could have managed that without inside help.
"They betrayed us," Ibana said.
The brothers looked at Ibana for a long few moments before Marcus ducked his head towards Stike.
"Three of 'em weren't hard to track down. We've been keeping an eye on 'em since. But this one..."
He nudged the kneeling figure with one boot.
"He ain't been seen since. We found him with the refugees yesterday."
Stike took a step toward the kneeling man and jerked the sack off his head, discarding it in the corner. The face that blinked up at him was familiar, if aged a decade. He was in his 40s, roughly the same age as Stike, and had greying brown hair and a wispy beard. He had a thick neck and muscular shoulders, which had made him a fantastic lancer, and he blinked up at Stike's face impassively. His left eye was swollen, nearly shut by a recent shiner, and Stike wondered which of the brothers had given it to him.
Sergeant Aggerston.
Stike remembered Aggerston as an implacable figure, unruffled by burned villages and slaughtered enemies. He'd been a sword for hire before the war, and joined up with the lancers for the spoils, always ready to go through the pockets of the dead after a battlefield. Stike had considered Aggerston a friend. Not close enough for secrets, but a man he'd share a beer with at the end of the day. Aggerston glanced at Ibana, more irritated than afraid, and gave a deep sigh.
"Stike," he replied. "I'm not a sergeant any more. Haven't been since the war."
"Yeah. And what have you been since the war?"
"A little bit of this. A little of that."
Aggerston's nonchalance suddenly touched something within Stike, and he could feel a rage building deep in his stomach.
"And this story the brothers are telling me, what do you make of that?"
"A bunch of rubbish."
Ibana snorted.
"He's lying."
"I am not," Aggerston protested.
"I played cards with you for 18 months, asshole. You look down and to your left when you bluff."
"I do not."
Aggerston looked down and to his left, then grimaced. He sniffed, his mouth forming into a hard line. When it became clear he would say no more, Stike began to pace. The anger was building, and he forced his voice to remain neutral, matching Aggerston's calm demeanor.
"You betrayed the lancers, Aggerston. You got me sent to the firing squad. Did you know what Fidela's Jess was planning?"
There was a long, empty pause, and Stike added,
"Don't pull this silent bullshit on me. You can either answer the question, or we can take a few minutes and bury you alive beneath this hovel."
Aggerston glanced around the room once more, and Stike could see the calculations going through his head. His chances of escaping, or putting up a good fight, or at least making them finish him off quickly. The corner of his lip curled, and Stike remembered something about his own experience playing cards with Aggerston. He always got surly when he was losing.
"2 million kroner.
Stike raised his eyebrows.
"Pip, you're joking, right?"
"Fidel's Jess really wanted you dead."
"I knew that. But 2 million? Stike scoffed. "I would have damn well just retired if he'd come to me first." "Oh, you wouldn't," Aggerston spat. "You like killing too much."
"Maybe."
Stike acted careless, but on the inside he continued to boil. Aggerston had been a comrade in arms, even a friend. To sell Stike out, even for so much money. He felt his facade crack and turned away for a moment so that Aggerston couldn't see the emotions playing out across his face.
"Why didn't you just put a knife between my ribs yourself?"
"Because I'm not stupid. These assholes would have hunted me down no matter where I went. There's not enough money to knife Ben Stike."
Stike almost gave Aggerston credit for that underlying assumption that he could have finished the job. Almost.
"And that money, did you spend it well?"
"Bought a townhouse in Upper Lanthal. Changed me name. Cut me head down. Spent the last decade whoring and gambling in places so expensive I was never likely to see a lancer again."
Aggerston gave him a shallow smile.
"So? Yeah, I spent it well."
Stike looked at his hand and flexed his fingers. 10 years in the labor camp,
When only a couple of miles away, one of the people who'd put him there lived a life of luxury and excess. He'd known about Fidelis, yes, of course, and his hatred was one of the things that kept him alive. But Jess had always been an enemy. Agerston? Not so much.
Stike remained looking at the wall, facing away from Agerston.
Cut his buns, he said.
Ibana stared.
What? You heard me?
Hesitantly, Ibana nodded to the others.
You sure, sir?
Marcus asked. Stike nodded, not trusting himself to speak. He flexed his fingers, feeling that twinge churning that rage.
Zack, do you have a pistol on you?
Yes, sir.
Is it loaded?
Yes.
Give it to Agerston.
Sir?
Now!
Stike turned around and glared at Zack, who licked his lips and glanced warily at Ibana. Stike held a hand toward her.
Don't say a damn word. Zack, give him your pistol.
Zack drew his pistol and handed it to Agerston as he climbed to his feet. Agerston brushed himself off and took the pistol, staring at Stike intently.
What's this?
His tone said that he sensed a trap, but he didn't know where it was. Stike took a step toward him and spread his hands.
You wanted me dead. You were paid to help put me in a grave. It didn't work. So here's your shot to earn that 2 million. Put a bullet in my head.
Without hesitation, Agerston lifted the pistol and took a half step forward, pressing the barrel against Stike's forehead. He pulled the trigger, and Stike heard the click and snap of the flint lock. Nothing happened.
You think you're hot shit, Agerston, Stike said, finally letting his fury unfurl. But you never paid attention. Zack still carries the same shitty, leaky powder horn he has for 15 years. Powder gets wet, and his pistol misfires 2 times out of 3.
As Stike finished the sentence, a look of panic spread across Agerston's face. He backpedaled and tried to flip the pistol around to use it as a weapon, but Stike was on him before he could take a second step. Stike drew his boss knife, dragged the blade along Agerston's sternum, and rammed it into the soft spot beneath his jaw, until the crosspiece touched skin and the tip jutted from the top of his skull. Agerston's eyes bugged. A rasping came from his mouth, and his body convulsed. Stike allowed his momentum to carry them against the far wall of the hovel and slammed Agerston's body against the rotted timbers. The whole house shook. His hands soaked with warm blood, Stike stared into Agerston's dead eyes.
"Who else betrayed me?"
he asked the brothers quietly.
"Bad Tenny Wiles, Val Yane, and Devore,"
Marcus answered.
"Where are they?" "Tenny Wiles owns a plantation about 100 miles west of here. Val Yane is a boxer in Belterror, and Devore is a general in the Fatrasten army."
Stike led Agerston's body fall.
"Toss him in the rubbish heap out back. He doesn't deserve a real burial."
He took a deep breath and clapped Marcus, then Zack on the shoulder, leaving a bloody handprint on each.
"Thank you. I needed that. Whatever happens these next few months, I'm going to find the rest of those assholes and kill them."
He looked at Ibana.
"Let's go find out what Flint is up to."
Chapter 9 Flora drank cold coffee at the table in the middle of her tent. She stared absently at the maps laid out in front of her and noticed that her hand was trembling. Olam sat on the corner of her cot, fiddling with a metal tin he kept his matches in. His face mirrored her expression. Absent, lost, shell-shocked. He licked his lips, opened his mouth as if to speak, but closed it again. She hadn't seen him this out of sorts since the Adrankes war. Taniel and Karpol were standing just outside their tent, waiting for Vlora's decision on the news they'd brought from landfall.
"Taniel wants us to go find these other two godstones,"
Vlora said.
"Is it our responsibility?"
Olam looked up, blinking away his own thoughts. Vlora continued before he could reply.
"We're Adrans. We have no horse in this race. The Phetrastans, Dionys, and Palo are going to spend the next few months, maybe even years, killing each other over these things. Why should we get involved?"
She slapped her palm on the table, almost spilling her coffee, feeling a sudden swell of anger.
"We're in this damn situation because I couldn't just keep my head down and do a job. I tried to arrest Lindet over these stupid things, and I managed to lose our allies on this continent in the process."
Olam clicked his match tin against the wooden frame of her cot, his expression conflicted.
"We've seen what gods can do to a country," he said.
"This isn't our country. We're mercenaries, and after a year in the swamps and two major battles, the men are almost spent. I'm not going to appeal to their patriotism, because this isn't an Adran matter."
"I agree with that."
"Then answer me this. Is this our responsibility?"
"No,"
Olam said. He tilted his head as if pained and said,
"And yes."
"Explain."
"Less responsibility," Olam said, "and more necessity. Back in landfall, you said that the world doesn't need any more gods, and I think you're still right about that. These consequences that you and I understand, I think it makes us responsible, even if our men are not. This world is not as large as it once was. You're still a member of the Adran Cabal, and we're both still Adran generals. We can either deal with a new god once this continent has finished warring over the stones, or we can try to prevent one from being born in the first place."
"So you'd argue that it is an Adran matter?"
"I'd argue that it will be. Unfortunately, we aren't accompanied by the Adran army. We're accompanied by mercenaries."
"So what do we do? Send the men home and you and I offer to join whatever it is Taniel is stirring up?"
"It's an option," Olam said. "But these things will probably be much easier with an army at our back, even if it's a little mauled right now."
Laura finished off her coffee, spitting the dregs out onto the ground and returning her gaze to the map on her table. Taniel had left two pins in the map. One of them was located on the edge of the Iron Hook Mountains, not all that far from here. The other was located on the west coast of Phetrasta. Flora tapped a finger on the tip of each pin, and then on New Adopest, the closest large port, not in the hands of the Dionys, and the best chance she had of getting an army back to Adro.
"Taniel!" she shouted.
A moment passed before the tent flap was thrown back. Taniel and Karpol entered. Karpol immediately rounded the table to examine the map in silence, while Taniel looked from Vlora to Olam with an irritating air of expectation. Vlora said,
"You told me once that you still have Tamas's foreign wealth at your command."
"I do,"
Taniel said, pulling back somewhat. This was not the question he'd expected.
"Good. Because Olam and I are in. This is a matter for the Adran army and the Adran Cabal, and we're the only representatives on the continent. However, this isn't the responsibility of my men."
She paused for a beat.
"But I'm not going to do this without an army. You're going to hire the Riflejacks. I expect every soldier out there who survives, and all the widows and widowers of the ones who don't, to leave this conflict as wealthy people. Understand?"
Taniel cocked an eyebrow. Across the table, Carpole grinned and nodded.
Done. I offered to hire you before, Taniel said.
That was before I grasped the stakes. Besides, I'm serious when I say wealthy. Our prices went up significantly since we last spoke.
Carpole shrugged and twirled her finger, as if saying the conversation was already finished and she was ready to move on.
All right, Taniel said. We'll hammer our details on the road.
One other thing, Flora added. You will give us objectives, but I will decide how they're carried out. You're not going to dictate what happens to the Godstones once we find them. Understand?
I see.
Taniel's eyes narrowed, and Flora could tell he was rethinking the idea. She leaned on the table, looking him in the eye.
I intend to destroy those things. That is my goal. No, that is the goal of the Adran Republic Cabal. No new gods.
You're making a lot of demands for a mercenary.
You didn't hear what I just said. I have a mercenary army, but I represent Adro in this matter.
And you have a look on your face that seems awfully uncertain for someone hoping for my help. I'm ready to go home right now, Taniel. Take it or leave it.
Taniel looked to Carpole, and the two shared a long, silent gaze.
Taken, Taniel said with finality.
Flora swallowed, her throat suddenly dry. She wished she had a few days to sleep on the decision. She wished she had a bigger, healthier army. And she wished she didn't feel like events were about to spiral out of her control.
What are you going to do about these armies we're pinned between? Taniel asked.
Olam, Flora said. When is dawn?
2 hours or so.
And what will the weather be like?
Oh, we've had a chilly night. Same as last night. And yesterday morning we had a thick fog until 10. I don't see things being different, dear.
Flora took the pins out of her maps and began to roll them up carefully.
Get everyone moving. I want us on track to be gone within 2 hours.
And you think the Phytrastans and Dionys are just going to let you leave?
Taniel asked flatly.
I understand both are looking for your head.
Fog will give us a head start, Flora said. The rest? Well, I have an idea. Olam, I want to see Stike, Gustar, and my senior officer corps. Valencian, too. I think he crossed the river, so you'll have to do that quietly. Now, get out of here so I can write some letters.
Dawn was almost upon them, and Flora stood by her horse and watched as the rest of her camp vanished before her eyes. Soldiers finished packing their kit, officers kept things orderly, and quartermasters examined the wagons of supplies they'd managed to bring over from the Phytrastan camp followers in the darkness. The fog, Olam had predicted, was thinner than she would have liked. It would mask their movements, but for only so long. Within hours, both the Dionys and Phytrastans would know that she'd given them the slip. The question Flora needed answered most of all was whether they would turn their focus on one another, or whether either general was dogmatic enough to come for her. A familiar figure appeared through the gloom, torch held high over his head, the scrap of bearskin still clinging to his shoulders. Valencian Haberbaden, known more widely as the Ice Baron, was nothing short of a walking miracle. He'd saved the Battle of Landfall by riding his merchant ships out on the tide to crash into and sow chaos among the Dionys' fleet. Somehow he'd managed to swim back to shore against the currents and recover from half-drowning, only to be on his feet again to help with the evacuation of the city. He spent every moment since then as a whirlwind through the refugee camp, redistributing supplies, breaking up fights, tending to the sick,
and organizing former small-time politicians into a genuine leadership for the refugees. Valencian had grown gaunt since they'd first met in Landfall a couple of months ago. He'd lost weight, his hair had grayed at the edges and remained uncombed, and his face seemed fixed by a frustrated scowl.
"You're leaving," he said brusquely.
"We are. Does General Holm know? I've been a guest of hers for the last day, and she's very intent on presenting you to Lindet."
Laura produced a letter she'd written less than an hour ago and offered it to Valencian.
"She will when you give her this letter."
Valencian stared down his nose at the paper and did not reach for it. After a long moment's consideration, he said in a low voice,
"Don't leave me with them."
"Excuse me?"
Laura was shocked to hear genuine dismay in his tone. "Are they mistreating you?"
"Quite the opposite. Holm has assigned me an entourage. I think she's having me watched. I had to pretend I needed a shit just to sneak out of my tent when your summons came. They're making me sleep in a real bed. These damned refugees are trying to elect me as mayor of this moving city we have gathered."
Despite her frayed nerves, Laura had to stifle a smile. "I can't think of anyone better suited."
"I could name a dozen in a single breath. Probably 100 if you give me the chance to think."
Valencian paced, gesturing as he spoke.
"These refugees don't need a mayor, and Holm has no intention of allowing it. They'll be split up and sent to whatever towns and cities can take them, as quickly as can be managed. I have no interest in being the general's guest, and I have no interest in being bullied into a position of leadership."
"But I thought you had taken well to helping."
Valencian stopped his pacing long enough to shake a thick finger beneath her nose.
"Helping!" he exclaimed. "Not leading. I'm a reluctant businessman at best. I will not be a politician."
"You're very good with people," Laura ventured. "They could use your help, at least until this refugee camp has been dissolved."
"Absolutely not. I will come with you, Lady Flint."
Laura resisted the urge to point out he hadn't been invited.
"You won't stay with them? At least for a few weeks?"
"No."
"Even if I request it personally?"
Valencian came to a stop and turned toward her cautiously.
"Why would you want me to stay with them? Are you trying to get rid of me?"
Laura could think of nothing more pleasurable or frustrating than the idea of having Valencian along on Taniel's mission. "I swear I am not. I know that you have done much for me. You damn well ended the Battle of Landfall. But I need a personal favor."
"I sacrificed my ships for Fatrasta," Valencian declared. "I would not humble myself to claim a favor for such an act. In fact, I intend on charging Lindet for those ships, and the revenue I've lost from their destruction."
"Reluctant businessman indeed," Laura murmured. "Valencian, I have about 700 men who are too wounded to march. I have discharged them from the company so they won't be treated as enemy combatants, but I need someone to care for them, to advocate for them, and if need be, to protect them."
Valencian drew himself up, chest puffing out.
"And you would trust me with such a task?"
"If it's not
too much? Oh, it would be an honor."
Laura saw the movement too late. Valencian, don't
hug me.
She found herself crushed against his broad chest, then thrust back at arm's length like a father examining his daughter on her wedding day. His face was red, his lips pressed in a tight line.
Please don't cry, Laura said.
I won't.
Valencian's voice cracked, and he dabbed at the corners of his eyes with his bearskin. Flora tried to reconcile the avenging angel piloting burning ships into the enemy fleet with the man standing before her on the edge of tears.
I won't,
he said with more confidence.
But I will have you know that I accept this task, and I will take it very seriously. Your wounded soldiers will not be neglected or used as bargaining chips, or in any way mistreated while I still live.
Flora wondered if there was a more genuine man in the entire world, and had no doubt that he would do as promised. Some will die from their wounds, she said quietly. Some will be cripples for life. Hopefully more will recover fully. You can send them on to New Adipes to take a ship home where they can claim their pension. If they are hale, they can come find me.
You're not going back to Adro?
Valencian's eyes narrowed curiously. It's best I not tell you where we're headed.
I understand.
Valencian reached out and plucked the letter from Flora's fingers.
I will deliver this to Holm immediately.
Flora held up a hand. If you would wait 2 hours, actually?
Exactly.
Valencian produced a pocket watch.
It will be done. Goodbye, Lady Flint. May we meet again under more favorable circumstances.
He gave a flourishing bow and backed away, then turned and disappeared into the fog. Flora watched him go, then turned to find Ben Stike waiting for her. She took a deep breath, letting it out slowly.
What a strange person, Stike said.
He's a good one, Flora said, somewhat more defensively than she'd intended. Stike spread his hands.
I heard what he did with his ships at landfall. Strange isn't an insult coming from me. You wanted to see me, Flint?
I expect you figured out we're leaving.
I gathered. My lancers are ready to ride, but no one knows where to.
Flora stood on her toes, peering into the dark fog for some sign of Olam. She spotted him nearby, his jacket discarded, while he and a trio of soldiers replaced a wagon wheel. "Where is Taniel?" she called to him.
"One, two,"
Olam grunted as he helped lift the wagon, and replied in a strained voice and the jerk of his head,
"Lassa saw. He was getting a new horse."
"Come with me," Flora told Stike. They walked over to a corral of captured Dainai's horses and found Taniel and Karpol going through the herd with a critical eye. She beckoned them over. While she waited, she turned to Stike. "You remember the Godstone, correct?"
"The thing we fought the Dainai's for south of landfall."
He rubbed his nose vigorously.
"That thing reeked of old sorcery. I didn't like it."
"I'll give you the short version," Flora said. "That Godstone is an artifact of immense sorcerous power. It is one of three that, in conjunction, can be used to create a new god. Taniel has hired us to find, secure, and hopefully destroy the other two Godstones before either Lindit or the Dainai's can find and use them." Stike stuck a tongue into his cheek.
"Huh?"
"I don't really care if you believe me. You and your lancers will be paid the same as my own Adrans, and Taniel is going to bleed gold for this."
"I've heard weirder things,"
Stike grunted. "Are you in?"
"Perhaps. Where is our objective?"
"The western coast of Hatrasta, at the end of the Hammer." Stike lifted his eyes to the sky, his lips moving silently, as if he were examining a map in his head. A small, strange smile touched the corners of his mouth.
"Money sounds good, and keeping Lindit away from her prize will delight the pit out of my lancers. So, yes, I'm in."
Taniel and Karpol joined them, and Stike gave each a nod. He eyed Carpole for several seconds before turning his attention back to Vlora.
"Excellent," Vlora said.
She'd expected more questions. Defiance, or... she didn't really know. Stike's legend never included him being easy to work with, so his quick answer was a relief. Taniel and Carpole managed to dig through the archives Lindet was forced to abandon in Landfall.
"Her personal archives," Taniel interjected.
Stike gave a low whistle.
"Huh. I bet those were full of fun."
"You have no idea."
"I think I do,"
Stike said with a tight smile. Vlora continued. "Lindet has the approximate location of both of the other godstones, but as far as we know, she hasn't actually found them yet. We don't know if they're hidden or buried by time or what. One of them is located in the Ironhook Mountains near a gold mining town called Yellow Creek. I'm taking my army up to try and find it."
"And you want the Lancers to find the other one?"
"Our information on the other one is more vague," Taniel spoke up. "We know it's out on the Hammer, probably in the vicinity of Starlight. We need someone mobile to go looking for it."
Stike looked from Taniel to Carpole to Vlora. Slowly, he took off his big ring and breathed on it, polishing the skull on the breast of his faded cavalry jacket.
"Have the Dionys landed on the west coast?"
"That's what Taniel's intelligence says," Vlora said, "though not in as big numbers as at Landfall."
She watched Stike's face for some hint of hesitation. She needed to go after both stones, but splitting her infantry was the worst possible scenario.
"And Lindet will no doubt have troops in the area," Stike added.
"Without a doubt," Vlora said. "I intend on putting Major Gustav and the remnants of his cuirassiers and dragoons under your command. You'll be riding with close to 1,000 seasoned cavalry."
Stike replaced his ring and opened and closed his hand, eyes on a thin white scar over the tendons of his wrist.
"Fewer might be better in this situation," he said. "But Gustav knows what he's doing. I'll take them."
He nodded to himself, and Vlora let out a soft sigh of relief. Losing her cavalry would be rough, but Stike could use them more fully on the coast than she could up in the mountains. Stike opened his mouth, and Vlora tensed in the face of protestations. He said,
"I can smell sorcery. I have a few other knacked in my company. But if Lindet's privileged, haven't found it yet, how do you expect a bunch of lancers to do it?"
Vlora glanced at Taniel, who snorted out a laugh.
"You remember that favour you owe me, Colonel?" Taniel asked.
"I do," Stike said slowly.
Carpole grinned, and Taniel put his arm around her waist.
"Well, I'm calling it in. You're not going to find the Godstone. She is. And you're going to make sure she survives, even if it costs the lives of you and every one of your men."
Vlora dismissed Stike and left Carpole and Taniel to pick out their horses for the journey ahead, hoping she'd make the right decision in giving Stike her cavalry. Something nagged at the back of her mind, something she couldn't quite put her finger on. She put it aside and found Olam just as the first company of Riflejack infantry began their march out of the camp.
"Everything's set with Stike?" Olam asked.
"He's in," Vlora said. "He'll take Carpole and go cause havoc in the west. Taniel will come with us to find and secure the other godstone."
"Does Stike know he's a distraction?"
Vlora grimaced. "Distraction is a harsh word. He has his orders, and he has Carpole. I dare say he has a better chance of finding and destroying his godstone than we do ours."
but sending him out across for Traster will draw attention away from us.
Stike is not a subtle man. I think he's well aware of that, and the dangers it entails. What's done is done. Oh, I gave Valencian a letter for home.
Flora dug into her pocket and produced a second letter, handing it to Olam.
Wait an hour, then send a runner to the Dionys camp.
Olam took the letter and held it in both hands, as if weighing it.
What did this say?
The first letter, Flora said, watching the last vestiges of the camp disappear as soldiers fell into marching formation, tells General Holm that I'm leaving. It also tells her that the Dionys General has orders to take my head and will march after me. She can either give chase, or she can use the opportunity to press on toward landfall.
And this letter?
Olam hefted the other note. It tells the Dionys General that I'm leaving, and that the Fatrastans also want my head, and will give chase, and that he can deal with whichever he deems to be the largest threat.
Olam stared curiously at the letter.
So you told them both the truth, more or less?
A half-truth, yes. The difference is that I expect Holm to believe me. I don't expect the Dionys to believe me. The Dionys will shore up their defences, maybe even send a couple of brigades after us, while Holm, being a competent general, will not want an enemy force behind her. She'll attack the Dionys as soon as possible.
We should have done this 2 days ago.
I didn't know the character of the enemy generals then, Flora said. Find me my horse and let's get going.
I hope this works.
Chapter 10 Stike sat astride Amrek, a mile northeast of where the Riflejacks had made camp the last few nights, and watched the column of infantry marching double time through the thinning morning fog. They'd left the river highway in favour of a dirt road through rougher terrain, where they could stay ahead of any pursuers. And Stike guessed that the two enemy armies would figure out their disappearance any time now. Supposedly, Flint had some trickery up her sleeve to keep the two armies occupied with each other. Stike didn't know. He didn't particularly care. It wasn't his problem anymore. In front of him in the saddle, Celine slept with her head against the crook of Stike's arm, snoring softly. He thought about waking her to watch the troops go by, but figured she'd had enough of soldiers for one lifetime. He adjusted her head to lay against his chest so he could lift his arms, and turned around to find Jackal waiting nearby. The Palo Bannerman sat easy in his saddle atop a captured Dionys horse, watching the columns pass. Stike nudged Amrek gently around to join him.
"What do your spirits say about all this?" Stike asked.
Jackal didn't take his eyes off the passing soldiers.
"That we're all going to die."
"Oh?"
Stike felt the hair on the back of his neck stand on end.
"But," Jackal added, "they always say that. They don't actually know when we're going to die. Just that it will happen, which is pretty obvious. Spirits are preoccupied with death."
Stike swallowed a lump in his throat.
"Was that a joke, Jackal?"
"I've been working with street children for the last few years," he said without smiling. "It helped me develop my sense of humour."
He finally looked up from the Riflejack column and gazed at Celine for a few moments.
"She's good for you, I think. Tempers your fury."
"I think 10 years in the camp's tempered my fury."
"That's not what the spirits say," Jackal replied.
Stike smoothed Celine's hair gently with one hand.
"I have no idea whether to take you seriously."
You added another to their number a couple of hours ago. Agustin, I believe.